Hello, hello, and welcome to the Velvet Studio. And we have a great show lined up for everyone today. I am very excited about the guest that we have lined up, which is looking to be quite the great group. We have some folks on the phone, and we have Sebastian here in the studio. Say hi, Sebastian.
Hello.
Oh, let me just try that again.
Hi.
There we go. Now people can hear you. I don't know how good an option that is, but so we've got some folks on the phone. How are you doing?
Great.
Excellent.
Yes, it works. There's always a moment of trepidation when you're not entirely sure if something will work or not, and I'm thrilled to say that it works. So my understanding is that we have Dr. Alan Lee, who's the co-principal investigator for the AMP2R study. Are you on the line?
Yes.
And I think we also have Christopher. And do you want to quickly introduce yourself, Chris?
It's actually Christian. My name is Christian Hui. I'm the community engagement coordinator and the AMP2R study coordinator at Asian Community Aid Services, known for ACAS.
Excellent. Now, I did have all that written down, but it was on a different piece of paper. So that's sorry about that. Just a quick moment of some brief confusion. We do have Jonathan Mayo, a local person in the community here joining us, and hopefully one of our regular co-hosts, Jake Nguyen, also joining us later. Although he is a little held up at the moment, so we may or may not see him. But alas, these things happen.
So why don't you actually say what the topic is?
Yes, absolutely.
You haven't done that yet.
I mean, we often go entire episodes without me actually establishing what the topic is. So, I mean, this could make a novel change. The topic today we're really looking at is resiliency, I think, within the Asian Canadian community. Really spinning off a lot from the study that yourselves did at ACAS. So I think if you're able to tell us a bit about that study, I think that will give the audience kind of a great place to work from in terms of getting an idea of what we're going to be talking about.
Sure. Christian, you want to talk a little bit about ACAS and how the project got generated?
So let me just talk a little about ACAS. So ACAS is one of the ethno-specific aid service organizations based out in Toronto, Ontario. We were formed in 1994 on World AIDS Day as a result of an amalgamation of three different local groups that were serving East and Southeast Asians who were impacted by HIV. We're the only ethno-specific aid service organization in Canada now that serves East and Southeast Asians. And
unfortunately.
Yes, unfortunately, but in a way, it's really great that we get to do the work that we do on a daily basis. So aside from HIV prevention, education services, and support services, we also work greatly, mainly with the LGBTQ communities. So we have, do educational programming with youth, men, women, trans women. So we're a small agency and with a size of about perhaps 15 staff, a lot of us part-time. And how the study came about, AMP2R study is, let me just explain the acronym. So the AMP2R it stands for Asian MSM,
Pathways
to Resiliency Study. So MSM would mean is more of an epidemiological term, which stands for men who have sex with men. And at ACAS, we actually don't often use MSM. We use more of the term gay or bisexual men. But due to, I guess in terms of the research study purpose, and sometimes there are some men who would have sex with other men that don't really identify themselves as gay or bi. So I think MSM can be interpreted as more of a broader term for the study. So Alan, do you actually want to talk about how this day came about, or you want me to continue?
We can talk about SLAM.
Right? Okay, so like as a community-based organization, we really work with our local communities, and the study, the genesis of it really came from a program, an event called SLAM, which means Sex, Love, Asian Men. That community forum really highlighted some of the health and sexual health and well-being issues that gay, bi, and trans Asian men had. It took place in 2011, and following a very highly successful SLAM, we actually were able to procure funding from the Canadian Institute for Health Research for a follow-up kind of a research planning meeting. So I think Alan can probably do more justice in terms of how that research process came about. But a lot of the researchers...
You went with ACAS then?
I was very new. I was a participant, I remembered. And there were academics, community members, service users, and just really came together for a day to think about, okay, what are some of the most relevant issues facing the Asian, gay, bi, and MSM community in Canada? Because the AMP2R study is a community-based research study, so we really hold to the principles of community-based research. It's important for the community to be engaged in coming up with what are some of the most relevant issues for the researchers to focus on. I think Alan wants to add something as well.
So I think like around the time of 2011 or so, like the whole conceptual thing about syndemics is all the rage, right? About the whole how various health and social issues impact the health and well-being of gay men. And I think what we at the same time see, though, was a lot of resilience and a lot of really innovative strategies amongst people who actually face a lot of discrimination but actually do quite well. And that's actually the majority. So instead of focusing on all the pathologizing and all the vulnerability-focused things, we really felt that it's important to tap into our community's resilience and trying to identify ways that we can nurture and foster those resilience.
So could you quickly define for us how are you using the word resilience? What does it mean, and what was it that you were actually studying?
Mm-hmm. So we kind of define resilience as the abilities and skills of people to cope with adversities and to derive strength and recover from adversities, right?
Okay.
So we want to kind of flip the whole concept of vulnerabilities and weaknesses on its head and trying to find ways to tap into the strength-based kind of approach to foster the well-being and support, you know, HIV prevention and support mm-hmm. in a more positive way. Yeah. So that's kind of the motivation for the AMP2R study. And also specifically, I think there's also a lot of emerging work that is identifying protective factors and strengths, but we also want to go a little bit beyond that and actually tease out the specific pathways and routes with which people navigate through those things. Not just the fact that, you know, we have supportive communities or we have, you know, information or we have, you know, cultural identities that support certain things, right? But
so it's
how
like
those things get applied or utilized during challenging times or transitions.
So you're defining problems more by their solutions.
I guess you could look at it that way.
Okay. Or from their our participants' experiences, lived experiences, I think, in terms of how they were able to draw from their individual or the community's collective strength.
Yeah. So it's about, you know, the growth and overcoming adversities and the strengths individually and collectively that got derived through those mm-hmm. processes. Right.
Okay.
Now, I know that in the study, you kind of loosely grouped the respondents into four categories. What were those four categories and the thinking behind them?
No, we didn't group the people in four categories. We asked people to identify which life transitions or experiences tends to pose the most challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And, that are more kind of meaningful for them in terms of exploring their responses that have impact on their health and sense of well-being. So those four themes came out from the participants in the early process of the focus groups, right? So people identify coming out, migration, sex and relationships, and their experience with HIV as the critical kind of life transitions or experiences that really inform and shape their identities, health, and sense of well-being.
Now, I think it's important to note that in Ontario, I think 20% of the population is of Asian descent, and that's even more out in BC. So I think there are lessons that can be taken from your study here and applied, not just in Toronto where you're based, but across the province and even nationally. Is this something that you think some of these innovative resiliency strategies that you came across, do you think they can be replicated in other provinces?
That is our hope. This is actually just a developmental study. The study is meant to identify strategic points of intervention so that we can actually develop a more full-fledged programs to support community resilience. And we actually were able to draw from those experiences and developed a program. So we're actually exploring partnerships and funding to try to pilot and replicate that throughout, first locally and then hopefully mm-hmm. eventually regionally and nationally. But that's kind of like the next step, right?
And those points of intervention would be the immigration, coming out, HIV, and sex and relationships?
Oh, you need more than an hour for us. Just the life transitions. What we were able to find is when people talk about those experiences, we were able to identify and draw from those experiences some kind of common or cross-cutting strategies that people applied, right, through the different life transitions or events. Some are unique to specific events, but some are actually kind of applicable to most of the different life experiences. So for example, whether it's coming out or moving or migration, people talk about a planned approach and a strategic approach where they, first of all, develop resources to assure their self-safety and independence, identify support system, and then identify allies within, like their families or the immediate community, that would support their coming out and moving away from an oppressive environment. Christian, maybe you can talk a little bit about
sure.
how people navigate through HIV and sex and relationships.
Yeah, so, some of the, strategies, in particularly from the focus group that were had HIV-positive participants, they really talked about their experiences with testing HIV positive and then really learning how to live as a HIV positive person. And part of a common strategy is really a resilient strategy is really reframing HIV as something as, negative into something positive. So, being able to kind of do that reframing and really prioritizing the needs of oneself. A lot of times when we, during the study, I think initially at least when talking with the study's participants, we asked them about strengths. I think the research team kind of felt that a lot of participants weren't readily vocalizing their strengths, but it's really through the sharing of experiences amongst the participants that they actually learn. And, through listening with others in the group and kind of realizing, oh, yes, these are actually the things that we as a group do or they can learn from one another, that they start really sharing more of their own strengths and recognizing those strengths that they have. So one of them is really about how can one living as an Asian man to really be able to prioritize one's most immediate needs, during these life transitions, and perhaps, while balancing the needs of they may have with their families or that with their communities.
So this kind of leads into a question of the sort of ethnocultural angle here that so when you're studying just the East and Southeast Asian community, there's sort of an implicit claim that there's something different about these individuals. What kind of patterns emerged that you think that made studying this group in specific very informative as opposed to just spreading it out to everyone?
I guess
are there unique strategies, for example, mm-hmm. or unique histories?
I guess the main insight that we learned is I think people can derive a lot of cultural identity-related strengths, but at the same time, being gay, a lot of people related to the traditional ethno-racial Asian culture as being homophobic or not accepting of gay people. So a lot of us grew up with that social context of oppression and how we navigate through that and in the cultural context is one important thing. And then the other thing is about the Asian culture or many of the, I mean, Asian culture is very diverse, right? But
yeah.
I guess there is a certain perception and certain reality that it tends to be more collectivist and, you know, people tend to put family and communities first before themselves. And that's how we are brought up, or there's a lot of family expectation or social expectations. And so how do you support the individual self needs and sense of identity when that's not necessarily the social norm or the heteronormative mm-hmm. kind of society set up, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and a lot of times people tend to react first by rejecting their culture and rejecting their community. And that actually can be very detrimental as well, because it kind of robbed you of a huge part of yourself that is also precious and resilient and protective. Mm-hmm. And I think through the experiences of the participants and through, you know, our also frontline working experience, we realized that the people who seems to have the most kind of sense of, most positive sense of self and well-being are people who are able to reconcile the different aspects of their cultural identity. Mm-hmm. So you don't just trying to distance yourself from your community, but you're able to draw from its strength and be able to challenge its homophobia. So I think that's kind of the important insight that we get, whereas a lot of traditional or previous work has focused on, you know, labeling how homophobic our culture is or how, you know, how non-conducive to supporting individual growth it's been, and ignoring the strengths and the merits that it also brings that helped us through many other challenges in life.
Right. So as sort of like an analog for a lot of people who are dealing with homophobia in Catholicism, they may not like the homophobia within Catholicism, but you can turn it around and you can say that Catholicism also teaches humility and acceptance and patience. And these are also things that if you band together with other openly gay Catholics, that you can actually derive something from Catholicism that is empowering. And it's not all bad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think you can draw some parallels to other cultures, other faiths, and, you know, other contexts, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to also, I guess, in a diasporic kind of community when a significant proportion of people are first or second generation immigrants, mm-hmm. It's also the context of being a racial minority and an immigrant in a social setting where you're also subjected to systemic exclusion and racism, right? So having those
cultural links and identities are also extremely important. So that's kind of beyond, you know, just holding on to traditional faith and stuff, but it's also having the system of support to counter some of the exclusionary experiences from racism, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you brought that up, because one of the questions that I wanted to pick up on was in terms of the sexual racism within the gay community. We at the show here have done multiple episodes around the topic of no fats, no femmes, no Asians. That was a phenomenon on Grindr a little while ago. Thankfully, we've seen a little less of that recently. But there is undeniably racism in the gay community. So from what I'm kind of picking up here, having that culture and the connection to your own culture can be a source of strength when combating that more systemic racism.
Definitely. Oh, I'm so glad we don't have to justify the experience to prove that it exists, because you have different programs talk about it already. Yeah, so I guess, you know, from our context, is obviously one is the exclusion on a personal level, right? In the actual sexual encounter and date picking. But I think there's also a larger systemic exclusion where people, queers of color's voices are not perceived to be representative or significant in the broader LGBT community agenda and issues. So that's, I think, feeds into each other. The more othering that we experience in the larger kind of social system, it kind of, you know, actually feeds into and give permission to more exclusion on an individual basis, right? And when, then, you know, Christian, sorry. I think you want to talk about the media and how it portrays Asian men.
Just
and all that.
Just before you do that, we do have Jonathan has just got here. So whilst I bring him into the studio, we were listening to Mikey Bustos' Revive Our Love.
Sure.
And we'll be back just after this. If I can get all the buttons to work. There we go.
Inside that love you felt when you and I were one. I it's you and him. You're two, not one within. It's so plain to see. Your love was meant for me.
Take us back,
baby, take
just
us back.
Home.
Baby, take us back.
Hello and welcome back, and that was Mikey's original song that not long got released, and we have Dr. Alan and Christian on the phone, and Jonathan, you just joined us in the studio. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Yes, everybody's mics work, this is great. I always feel a sense of accomplishment when everything seems to still be on the line, so that's always good. Now, just before the break, we were talking about... kind of channeled my inner BBC then. Just before the break, we were talking about... actually, one random aside, whilst I've got BBC on the mind, I'm British, in case you didn't know that, and we just found out that apparently the premiere episode of The Great British Bake Off had more viewers than the Olympics.
I would believe that.
So we're a bit of a stereotype as a nation.
Who's hosting it this year?
It's the same people.
Okay, then I'll watch it.
Yeah.
They're fantastic.
They are great.
I've never seen
so you're missing out. You're massively missing out. We're going to have a viewing party tonight. It's going to be a lot of fun. If you want to join us at our viewing party, tweet at Velvet Studio 1. Sebastian will give you a piggyback to the party.
The main thing to bear in mind about the British is that they're known for terrible cooking, except for desserts. And when you watch The Great British Bake Off, you realize how amazing British desserts are. Because there's one episode where they're like, oh, we're doing pie crust. We're doing salt water. Warm pie crust. Do you know how to do this? And this one lady was like, no, I don't know how to do this kind. And they're like, well, how many pie crusts do you know how to make? I think about 15 or 16. And then the host was like, oh, we'll make that better. Don't worry. And it's like, what? How many pie crusts do they have in England? And they really actually do have dozens of ways of making pie crust.
Anyway, that's a completely unrelated note to sexual racism. My apologies.
Yeah, before the break, we were going to talk about the... We were talking
about...
Sorry, we started chatting about the Great British Bake Off. This happens from time to time. My apologies.
It's good to have some levity.
It is. It is. And Sue Perkins does bring that. This is true.
Oh, does she ever.
Yeah.
So...
do they do velvet cake?
Ooh.
That's actually a Southern recipe. American South, yeah.
They do sometimes do. They do like the German cakes and they do like the French layered cakes. Anyway, this is not an episode about the British Bake Off. Oh my gosh.
A resilient strategy.
Yeah.
Baking. Yes.
No, it is, absolutely, actually. No,
this is true.
I lived on Booth Street, there was a reason why I was baking like twice a week.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm gonna loop it back into the context of the show. So earlier we were talking about you mentioned how being able to tackle racism by having a stronger connection to your cultural community was a source of strength. And I have to say that as a British expat myself, you know, occasionally reconnecting to British culture through things such as the Great British Bake Off does give me, you know, a bit of a strength and reconnecting with family and so on. As a white person, I don't really experience any racism. As the purveyor of most of the racism, i.e. white people, not me personally, of course.
But when you're in England, they notice that you're Welsh.
It's true. Well, they're English, that's why.
So, yeah.
Anyway, that's a little connection trying to loop Bake Off to the topic. I failed epically at that, but moving swiftly on.
That's fine.
Moving on. Yes, so we're talking about... we talked about just now about having... a sense of culture, and we may touch on... I might want to dig a little bit more about reconciling homophobia within diaspora communities with being GLBT, but we may not get to that. But I want to talk about how do you navigate sexual racism within the gay community, and how can the broader gay community kind of get its act together and stop being such dicks, I think, essentially, is the approach. So this is a very big question. So from your study, how have people shown resiliency in the face of sexual racism?
I think, you know, in terms of the study's participants, they talked about, you know, how sexual racism plays out in different ways. For example, you know, like, are the issue of masculinity, are Asian men considered masculine? Or, you know, in terms of how usually the dominant gay community views of queer Asian men. The participants stated that there's this feminization of Asian men as a phenomenon, and then how do the power dynamics, you know, either real or perceived, are played out within these relationships, right? So I think in terms of the connection piece, we talked about, you know, Grindr as a prime example of what's been happening, of sexual racism being played out, targeting Asians. And I think, you know, as you know, this is, has been an ACAS sponsored research study, and some of the work that, you know, we do at ACAS as well is really providing that cultural safe space for queer Asians, gay, bi, and trans Asian men to really come together. And so we can feel comfortable about who we are, regardless of our, you know, cultural background, our sexual identities, our body sizes or shapes, and just being able to kind of bond over, let's say, we mentioned baking, food is a big piece, you know, that's really a good way to start off conversations. So it's just really having that comfort level first. And I think that in terms of overcoming the sexual racism, it's really knowing that we don't need to strive for the ideals that's been set out by the dominant gay community. You know, you often see certain images or body sizes out there, and is that really realistic for us to, you know, kind of go after? Or are we?
Or should we embrace that as the only versions of beauty that, you know, we support, right?
Right.
And I think the other thing is about, I guess, like having that safe space and having peer support for self-affirmation. I think that's important. But also, I think it's about having awareness of how that, you know, in a different way fits into the systemic homophobia, right? To become like a certain model or stereotype that you have to fit in order to be desirable, to be accepted, rather than being who you are.
So I just want to hit the brakes just for a second. We want to kind of make the show a little bit more accessible. So you mentioned a couple of things. I want to quickly just define some terms for our listening audience. And I think, Sebastian, you took note of a couple of them.
Yeah, I have an additional question.
Oh, okay. So you mentioned how when you were talking about the representation of Asian men through portrayal of masculinity and the feminization of Asian bodies. I mean, as somebody with academic backgrounds, I think everybody here in the room gets that, but for our listening audience, kind of what does that in reality look like? What would that mean to Joe Schmo in the street?
So I think the stereotype is like Asian men's meek and not, you know, strong and big muscle, and they tend to be bottom, and they expect to be submissive in bed.
Mm-hmm. Or the penis size are often, you know, a topic that they refer to, as Asian men have specific, you know, maybe the stereotype is Asian men have smaller penis size. I don't know how they ever got that, you know, notion to come about.
So I think that kind of manifests itself in kind of all the interactions socially, cyberly, and it also tends to, a lot of Asian men might kind of think that that's the only options they have. Mm-hmm. To be a bottom and to submit to whoever and whatever is offered to them, right? So that, I think, is probably kind of the bigger context.
I have another question. I'd like to bring our studio guest in on this as well. So this is a little bit more of a complicated question, and if you're not sure how to answer this, that's okay, because I'm sure it's hard to put into words. Now, to sort of disclose, I have lived as an expat in both Hong Kong and in Japan, and I participated in the gay community there as it is. But the thing is, like, so something you mentioned early on in the episode is you were saying that not all of the participants that come in identify as gay or bisexual, And this happens in the West as well, but something that I noticed when I was over there is that, well, in both Hong Kong and Japan, and it's very different ways in both cases, but they have something like a gay identity, but it's not a gay identity. That being a homosexual or a bisexual in China and Japan has different flavors to it. It's a different thing. And so you have people who say, like, I've met a lot of people, even when I was over there, who said they did not identify as being gay or bisexual, but they did acknowledge that they were, and they were open in their lives that they had same-sex attractions, but it was something else. It was the Western concept of gay that they didn't identify with, and there was something else that they did identify with. So I don't know how to frame it other than can you expand on that and explore that.
is there something similar to that in the Philippines? You know, is there the Western construct of gay as in, you know, the Stonewall riots and pride parades, or is there something more indigenous that exists?
Or what does gay look like, basically?
Right. This is actually something I was thinking about last night, and when I think of gayness in the Philippines, there's two sort of prevailing manifestations I can think of. The first is what I would imagine most Filipinos think of as being traditionally gay. You have somebody who's attracted to men, but also somebody who's attracted to the same sex, but also displays certain stereotypical characteristics, at least according to Filipino culture. So in this case, I'm thinking of a few TV stars here in the Philippines who are gay, and they're very flamboyant. They're very feminine, and in my head, that's sort of the main image Filipinos have of gay people. And so when you talk about people who are attracted to the same sex but don't identify as gay, they probably don't identify, at least in the Philippine context, with those stereotypical characteristics. Mm-hmm. I think that would be my answer there.
Yeah. So I think what we probably can help ourselves is by expanding our perception of what is defined as gay, right? Because I think what kind of troubles the discussion is that, you know, like, most people think the Western definition of gay and gay liberation is the ultimate.
Yeah, it's all there is.
You know, of what being gay is supposed to be. Whereas I think in many different cultures, sexuality is much more fluid. And, you know, and even like in Canada, I think the indigenous community look at sexuality as a very fluid, two-spirited concept, right?
Yeah.
And so I don't think that's necessarily just a East versus West thing. But I think what is important is that I think because of the dominance of the Western world in a lot of popular culture and, you know, political scene, it tends to define everything in that context. And so everything that is different becomes exotic and kind of bewildering to people. Mm-hmm. But I think it's actually a lot of cultures actually do look at same-sex love attractions in a much fluid way. But I think the social context sometimes lends itself to very heterosexual kind of normative oppression, which unfortunately would become like the commonalities in those contexts, right?
Is it something that you dealt with when you're doing the study, finding people who at first they don't identify as gay, but then after a while they open up that they would identify with gay culture if, like, what am I trying to say? If they are their own equivalent of gay, but they don't identify with the word gay, but they acknowledge that they have same-sex attraction. And so were they harder to bring into the study? There you go. That's what I'm trying to say.
Like, for example, we did some reach out to the local community here through Whisper. We're big fans of Whisper here on the Velvet Studio. And someone got back to me and said, you know, they're not gay, but they go to a sex cinema and hook up with men. but they don't remotely identify with the culture or the community here in Ottawa. I immediately was like, you know, how do you negotiate consent in the sex cinema? Like, what's the context there? But that may be a bit over this individual's head.
If you sit within 3 seats of someone.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's where the whole notion of MSM comes from, right?
Yeah.
And when you know, just when you get defined sexuality by the sexual act versus
the identity.
Yeah.
So I think there's two separate things, really. I mm-hmm. think, you know, a lot of us, or a lot of people are capable of having sex with many different kinds of people, mm-hmm.
Without
and both
it being
genders,
part of your identity.
And you know,
yeah.
But not everybody identify a certain feeling or attraction emotionally.
Yeah.
So I think that's a different thing, really. But in our study, I think while most of the people came through various connections through ACAS or through people who utilize ACAS services, some are not existing service user, but through peer network, word of mouth, and we try to reach beyond the usual suspects that are already utilizing our programs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it tends to be a younger crowd, and it does include a lot of people who are new immigrants as well as people mm-hmm. who've been here for decades and people who were born here who are Asian.
Yeah.
So I think there's a spectrum, and I think that not necessarily all people who are immigrants identify themselves having a harder time articulating same-sex attraction, and not everybody who's born here are totally comfortable about being gay as, you know, as is defined by the mainstream Canadian
mm-hmm.
society.
Mm-hmm.
So our study was, you know, an exploratory study with 51 Asian gay or bi men or MSM. So it's actually, the sample size is quite small, and it's a qualitative study. You know, out of all the participants, 90% of them identified as gay, 8% as bi, and 2 as questioning. I'm not sure if, you know, like, the study actually helped participants better identify their own sexual identity per se during the process, but I felt that, you know, as a part of the research team in the process, that I felt they were more comfortable talking about sex for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in terms of, you know, the topic about MSM, you know, it's interesting that this is not really related to the AMP2R study, but ACAS actually did a pilot project called Straight Talk, trying to target and reach out to men who don't identify as gay or bi, but who actually have sex with other men. So it was a project that was completed about 2 years ago, and we tried to really figure out ways to see how, but to better understand the needs of these men and see if we can find ways to target safer sex messages to this group of men. But I think for the purpose of the AMP2R study, I remember one thing that some participants said was, you know, as Asian gay men, they often felt like they could pass as straight men, or at least they felt like people from the dominant culture,
right,
society, they don't necessarily think they're gay because they don't look or act gay. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's these kind of factors act in such, you know, multi-layered ways. It's not just about the individual per se in terms of how one identifies himself. It's also, you know, how are they perceived within the broader community.
Mm-hmm. So it's that sort of collectivist
mm-hmm.
angle again. I mean, something that I noticed, at least in Japan, this was less true in Hong Kong for sure, is because a lot of it is you're more defined by your relationships than you are by your individual personhood.
Mm-hmm.
Your individual personhood is the collection of all of your relationships, basically. Like, you're defined by how you fit into the world, more so than not. I mean, that's not the whole story. It's more complicated than that, obviously. But people who went to gay bars identified as gay, and those who didn't did not identify as gay. And it was basically because they were in gay spaces and they had gay friends that, because they were in the community, they were comfortable identifying as gay. And then otherwise, they were just like, I'm just some guy, and I just have sex. And that was something that I noticed very early on.
It was interesting. I recently went to Vietnam with my partner, and the culture there was... I was amazed to find it's never been illegal to be gay in Vietnam.
Ever in the history.
Ever, 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 ever. And you're now in front of
marriage, too.
Yeah, I know, which is incredible, but... you know, and I was talking obviously to my partner Jake about this, and I said, you know, is how does that reflect in acceptance levels of homosexuality? And the what he told me was that because of the patriarchal nature of the society there, that it's more culturally frowned upon, even though it's not illegal. So that was really interesting, and seeing how that materializes itself in different ways.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Now, everybody likes to think that Canadians are pleasant and friendly and apologize if you bump into them.
It's more true than it isn't. It's not entirely.
I'm going to get some very politely worded angry emails at the end of it for trying to dispute this lovely Canadian myth.
Yeah.
But my question is, do we see racism here in Canada? Now, Joshua, have you experienced sexual racism through... whatever means, or am I wrong and Canadians are actually on the whole quite nice?
I mean, I like to think that Canadians on the whole are quite nice. But no, yeah, definitely occasions of sexual racism, I would say. And a lot of ways that the our guest from ACAS has described, actually.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of... this idea of feminization, I think, it was a big problem I've encountered a lot. And more surprisingly, and I think something that hasn't been mentioned, is under-sexualization. I think sometimes people don't realize that I am a sexy person. Those are a couple of the ways I would say. But outliers.
I bring this up because I attended a Rainbow Health Ontario conference, which is actually where I first came to hear of your study. It was not the last one, but the one before. And I think there was an additional study being presented at the time that was looking at the impacts of racism in the gay community on HIV infection rates and the how racism impacts the ability to negotiate consent. And you may be able to speak to this more, the folks on the phone here, you know, because we talk about the feminization of Asian bodies and, you know, the stereotypes around masculinity and how Asians may have to fall into stereotypes in order to be accepted in the broader LGBT community.
And the assumption that they're meek and accepting. And,
absolutely. Yeah. So... one of the real consequences that we found in this other study that I am blanking on the name of was that impacts someone's ability to negotiate safer sex practices. Is this something that you've come across in the qualitative study that you did or in the work that you've done?
I think, you know, I remember study participants definitely kind of had stated that, you know, as a gay... or by Asian men, just as a result of the multiple kind of oppressions they face as, you know, due to racism, due to sexual racism, perhaps due to HIV status, it's often sometimes more difficult for them to negotiate, how to enter or negotiate sexual practices when they, you know, two people or more people get together. So I remember some participants that said yes, you know, like they felt like if someone was going to, suggest, let's get it on, then they may not be able to properly negotiate how to protect themselves, fully. But yet, I think there's also been other participants who have demonstrated that, you know, they have learned the skills to actually be able to negotiate how to protect themselves better or, you know, like negotiate consent as well. So I think there's a broad spectrum in terms of this issue, but I think, you know, if you want to look at how sexual racism impact, you know, gay Asian men as a whole. It does have some impact, and I think for our study, we just not only want to focus on the negative part, but also the resilience part of it.
Yeah.
So I think I mean, in a very simple terms, I remember I was speaking at the Ontario Gay Summit a few years ago about sexual racism, and in my younger days, I would experience very different options and response when I go to bathhouse here versus sauna in Asia, right? Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, just suffice to say that, you know, I have many, much more options and people who appreciate me over there than here. Mm-hmm. And I think it does affect my self-esteem, and it affects my sense of, you know, who I would go with and whether I feel I have as much power to negotiate what kind of relationships or acts that I get engaged in because of that. You know, so if I'm desperate and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and I haven't had any choice of my own, then I might accept things that I normally won't, right? Whereas if I have people line up to want to have sex with me, then obviously my sense of what options I have and how I can choose to enjoy sex would be very different. So I think that's just very, very simple kind of personal responses. But I think the other thing is about not having your images reflected in the media and not having, you know, having the popular culture keep defining you as others and as not somebody people aspire to, right? I mean, that's why having a black president is so important in
right.
the States.
Yeah.
Having a woman prime minister would be important because people didn't think those things were possible unless until it happened. And I think for a lot of minority communities, we still did not have that representation or, you know, visible role models in kind of the bigger systemic level.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of another manifestation in racism, not just about how many times we see no Asian, no femmes, you know, in the grinder, right?
Yeah. So the participants actually kind of stated that, you know, aside from being able to access the right kind of information on, you know, I guess sexual health information, it's important that they have, you know, be able to be connected to peer support networks and being able to have positive gay role models or mentors or peers, and just being able to have that opportunity to get a stronger sense of who they are as, you know, you know, as an Asian person, right, as a gay or bi Asian person, and being able to talk more openly about sex, so being able to be sex positive and being comfortable to explore one's sexuality, perhaps, you know, in safer ways. So those are all the kind of, like, important strengths and strategies that many of the participants have mentioned in the study.
And people talk about, like, you know, like, very concrete, you know, like, real life skill kind of thing, you know, how do you address those sexual negotiation in a more humorous real life kind of way, right? And some people English is a second language and they may not feel as comfortable asserting themselves in that, and then if you have to repeat what you say in 5 times before your partner can understand what you're saying, then, you know, you probably change or stop trying to explain things, right? So the other thing is about having that safe space for people to really hash out and develop some of those languages to be able to negotiate in real-life setting. It's no different than when we started talking about safer sex workshops at the beginning, since the very beginning of the HIV epidemic, right? Because everybody has to learn to negotiate about condom use.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we've taken a lot of those things for granted, but, you know, there's still a lot of people who really doesn't have that language or experience navigating through that. And a lot of people, I think, for older gay men or MSM, you know, who didn't come out in the internet age or who have been in long-term relationship and now being single again and has to go out to the scene, that's another language people have to learn, right? The internet, the cyber language of cruising and picking people up. So I think it's a constant process for a lot of people.
Now, you mentioned earlier about how important it is to see yourselves reflected, and I think, if I recall correctly, the Black Lives Matter protests in Toronto, one of their key protest elements was to have more funding to the Southeast Asian stage. And I know that here in Ottawa, sadly, there's as far as I could tell, no programming for the Asian community, by or for the Asian community. And I think you're right. You know, if we want to create more of a sense of community, that is a step that perhaps the broader community can do to be a bit more welcoming, is to kind of help to empower these platforms for you folks to see yourselves reflected and be empowered that way and create that sense of community. Sadly, we have run out of time. We've run out of time. I ran out of breath halfway through the word time there.
That means we had an exciting conversation, I guess.
Absolutely. And we'd love to have you on again. So next time, if you folks do any more reports or studies, let us know, and we'll surely have you on to discuss. And I think next month we are discussing refugees for the month, minus the last week. We're looking at it, Refugee Month. Of course, there is a huge international refugee conference where hopefully we're going to see some progress made on the tens and tens of millions of folks who are currently without a home. And Canada has been leading the way in terms of LGBT refugees. So that's great news there. Anyway, that's all we have time for. Thank you so much for joining us. We've got Dr. Allen and Christian on the line, and Joshua here in the studio, and sadly Jake couldn't make it. Thank you so much. And we're playing
and
Sebastian and we're playing out with Casey Masija.
I tried to email so that we can stay in touch.
Absolutely. And we tried to choose some folks who had Canadian Asian connections, so that explains our music. Anyways, that's all for now. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you so much.